Welcome to the Men of Aid Gang podcast for Saturday, January 10th, 2009. This is Steve Borsch, and on is the gang members, Phil Wilson.
Hello.
Tim Elliott.
Good morning.
Graham Thickens.
Yo.
Yo. And yo. Our very special guest today, Ed Kohler. Ed, how you doing?
I'm doing great.
Excellent. You are, as I understand it, you are a web strategist working in the real estate industry, wheretolive.com, right?
That's correct.
And you guys help companies and agents make better use of the web to build the business?
Yeah, we generally work with like large real estate brokers to help them build a platform for their company and run their search engines for their websites, handle all the MLS feeds, run the email for all their agents, things like that.
Got it. Well, rather than dive into everything, Ed, you're making me feel guilty. You know why?
Why is that?
Because you are like an online animal. I mean, the Dietz.com technology evangelist. You're doing that Juicy Lucy restaurants thing, haystack and a needle. Saw that video that you did at Minpo that was done about you at Midpost about going out and covering gang graffiti with, a spray can or a spray machine with out of the back of your car and with used paint. And oh my gosh, lunchtalks.com. It's just, do you sleep?
I spend a lot of time on the internet.
Yeah. But
I sleep sometimes.
Oh, that's great.
It's good.
Good.
So do you practice a GTD or how do you prioritize all this stuff?
That's a good question. I just kind of crank stuff out as it is, I'm passionate about it. So say something like the Dietz, I tend to just kind of blast out four or five posts in a row that are kind of just things I have kind of queued up in my Google Reader that I'm interested about. So I tend to write most of the posts like within an hour or one day of the week, and then queue them up, and then they all roll out. So it's not like I set aside a certain time to do something like that, and that's kind of how I do a lot of the projects. As far as like blogging related things go, is just kind of go deep on one topic for a while, and then walk away from it, and then go deep on something else. So I don't know, for me that's a workflow that works pretty well.
Yeah, that's a good strategy. Unlike a lot of us that probably sit down and scratch our heads saying, what am I going to write about today?
Well, it wouldn't work if it wasn't for being able to queue stuff on WordPress.
Yeah, fabulous.
I was going to say, Ed, don't you travel a lot too? And do you do a lot of this on the road and sitting in airports? It seems like I see stuff from you where you're obviously, waiting in an airport or something.
Yeah, I do. I travel a week or two a month and meeting up with clients, or I do a lot of classes on, for the websites we launch. I teach classes on blogging strategies or trying to help people just make their sites better. I've done a couple classes on how to use Twitter better, things like that. So while I'm in airports, that is a time where I get to catch up a bit or on an airplane. And, then the stuff flows when I hit the ground and have a connection again.
So I was wondering, Ed, how is social media kind of taking hold in the real estate industry, or is it taking hold?
It is definitely taking hold, and it's something that the amount of technology that real estate agents are comfortable with is there's an extraordinarily wide spectrum, from people who are just out of college or just out of high school who are fairly tech savvy to people who are at a point in their life where they see this stuff coming on and they think they might be able to get away with not having to learn how it works. And the thing is, sometimes they're right about that, because people who are really established in real estate, they get most of their business from referrals from previous clients who are coming back to sell a home they sold them previously. And so it's more relationship-based than technology-based. But for newer people who are trying to build a business, they have to figure out which tactics they're going to use. And are they going to go out and buy bus benches? Or are they going to, farm a certain neighborhood by doing a lot of direct mail pieces? Or are they going to, use things like Facebook or Twitter to build up a network of people who trust them?
Are people more interested now in the real estate community than before? Now that, has it brought any clarity to, oh my gosh, I've got to do significantly more outreach?
But I think one thing that's changed in real estate in the last few years is one technique that's been popular for a long time is called farming. And that's where an agent will kind of claim a neighborhood and say, they'll just kind of say, I'm going to own this neighborhood. And so this is where I'm going to buy the bus benches or put up the billboards or direct mail things. And it's become a little bit less regional now because it's easier to reach a larger number of people over a larger metropolitan area if you're using the web to do it. And so you're not necessarily locked down to, I'm going to own Highland Park, St. Paul, for example.
Yeah.
So you can mix things up in that way. But I don't know, what was the other part of that?
Well, just in terms of are people embracing what you're offering more now than they were before? I mean, now that times are tougher, are they more open to new solutions?
Absolutely, because when things are really rocking in real estate, they have a hard time just keeping up with the business. So where they're allocating their marketing dollars is what the last thing on their mind. It's one more thing for them to think about. So the things are really cooking. It's more ego-driven than it is analytical and rational. So they'll get in battles over who has the biggest billboards or who has the most space in the newspaper, things like that, where it's not necessarily rational at all, but they have the money to do it. Who cares? But right now things have changed dramatically and they're starting to really wake up to the fact that newspapers are not somewhere that they need to be, and they might not even be able to be there because the newspaper might not even exist. So, and with the market being slower, they're actually taking time to think about these things. So while the industry is certainly slow right now, for us, it works out okay because a lot of people are saying, all right, we can cut money here, but we know we have to keep the website. And if we're going to have a website, it should be a good one. So they can find money in a lot of cases because of that.
Yeah. Well, God, speaking of newspapers, none of this comes as a huge surprise based on the size of the Star Tribune, but there was buzz the last couple of days about some union meeting that was held where somebody allegedly made a statement about that they were going to file bankruptcy within 2 weeks. I don't know if you guys have heard that.
Yeah, I noticed that. I think it's no surprise that the newspaper industry has been in really deep trouble for a number of years. And the last couple of years, you've been seeing these stories about, when are they going to die? And I think they're kind of in a death spiral because they've got a 19th century business model with, unions to deal with and that kind of thing. Plus you've got, news aggregation, which has gone to the web and, their response is to cut costs by, cutting down on the journalists, and that makes the content worse. And then, people start unsubscribing. So I don't see any resolution. I don't foresee any resolution for these guys.
You guys remember that media conference that was held here in the Twin Cities? And before that, they had a several day session. Phil, you were at that, the New Pamphleteers Conference. The interesting thing was, is I decided before that to go back and poke around and do a little searching and historical searching on what the hell was a new pamphleteer, and learned that before the advent of newspapers, when the colonies were young, people were going in with their news or their information or their rant, and they would have these pamphlets created, and then they would distribute them. And newspapers were essentially the first aggregators. So I keep thinking about how, now people look back at the railroad and say, they thought they were in the railroad business, but they were actually in the transportation business. I wonder if someday we'll look back and say newspapers weren't in the newspaper business. They were in the aggregation business. And that was the shift they'd never made.
I could see that being the case. They at this point, they're primarily, I think, in the media business, where no matter where the content's coming from, it's bringing eyeballs together and then selling ads against those eyeballs. Where the LA Times, actually, I think Jeff Jarvis wrote the other day about that I guess their web revenue is enough to cover their costs, where if that's truly the case, I mean, and they're one of the first newspapers, I guess, that has reached this point. But if that's the case, they can shut down the printers tomorrow and have a viable business. You know, it's a much smaller business when it comes to, you know, total dollars, but it's actually profitable, or at least break even at this point, which is actually a huge milestone to reach.
That's what's happening, is a lot of them are going to be going to online only. The Seattle Post-Intelligencer just announced that they're up for sale, and if they don't have a buyer in 60 days, they'll be online only.
Yep, Christian Science Monitor, same thing, they went online. Lots of examples.
Yep.
In general, the case, the revenue on the online side just hasn't been anywhere near what they've been able to get for print ads, and so... You know, I think a lot of them want to do that. They're just not ready to do that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, all right. So I still subscribe to the Star Tribune. Still get that every day. Probably showing my age, but also the New York Times Sunday. And in today's Variety section is a great big above the fold geek TV. Make is a new TV show that gives you the guidance and courage to unscrew the back of an old VCR. Blah, blah, blah. And Tim, I know you've seen the first one that was broadcast, and there's another one out now, right?
Yeah, yeah. I was just flipping the station the other day on the high definition band, and TPT ran the first show, I think on Tuesday or Wednesday, whenever I tweeted that out. And so I saw that one, and then, you know, I've been noticing that they're podcasting these things out on iTunes too, and then they're putting them on their website. So I was just before the show looking at the episode 2 on the web. And I really think this is kind of the future, where you've got, you know, Geek Squad, which is, you know, Best Buy sponsoring the thing, and it's going out on public TV. It's going out on the web. It's going out in iTunes. So people can consume this kind of, you know, this kind of content whenever they want.
So all coming out simultaneously.
Yeah.
Yeah,
yeah. And what's interesting is it's a reflection of the maker culture. So all the people that contribute to it are also the people that are consuming it. So I think that this is a great, you know, use of video to really mobilize a community. And it's what's really interesting is that they're able to do this on, you know, television as well, not commercial, it's public TV, but, you know, professional television as opposed to just podcasting.
You know what's so fascinating about this is that the you know, when the magazine first came out, and it is expensive per issue. You know, the subscription isn't too bad, but it
only comes out 4 times a year, Steve. So
right, but it is absolutely. I mean, it's an incredibly fun magazine to read if you're into any of that stuff. I'm sure you guys watch Tech TV, Screensavers, those shows. Yes. No.
Yes. Yep. Back in the day.
Yeah. Back in the day. Absolutely. Yeah. So when they went away, there was this big void in geekdom for great content. And so today, now we see Kevin Rose as the, you know, the number one in terms of Twitter follower. I think he's number one in Twitter followers. Revision 3, the online network has come to the fore, and all this stuff. And so this is a pretty good strategy on their part.
Yeah, what's interesting is all those guys that were on Tech TV are part of the new IPTV kind of infrastructure.
Yeah, yeah.
Leo Laporte, it's all the same people, Leo Laporte and Jim Lauterbach and, you know, yep. Patrick Norton, all those guys.
Yep, exactly.
Make is a venture of O'Reilly Publishing, right?
Right. Yeah, but Mark Fraunfelter, the guy that is one of the key Boing Boing people, also is I think he was the founder of it. I'm not mistaken.
He's the editor in chief.
He is, yeah.
But okay. I think it was his idea too.
Yeah, yeah.
And then he got some really good people like Phil Terone and others around it to actually produce the content.
Yep, yep. So what about can I just say one more thing? I wanted to jump into the Best Buy layoff thing, but I don't know if you guys are feeling it. But of course, now if I'm going to follow everything that you're doing, Ed, I'm going to be expanding my content universe dramatically, I think. But it's there is so much stuff. I ranted 6 months ago about the fact that on my iPod at the time, or my iPhone at the time, I had 31 hours of podcasts to listen to. I thought, I don't have 31 hours because they keep coming. And now, watching video online, I've got stuff queued up that I had 10 hours this past weekend of stuff queued up to watch. I thought, I just don't have that kind of time. Are you guys running into that too?
Oh, yeah.
I know. Yeah. I know for myself, one of the things that I've gone through and I kind of find myself in from time to time and have to take a step back on is redundancy of RSS feeds, where, like, say I study a lot of things related to search engine marketing. So, you know, at first I'd subscribe to, you know, every blog I could find on the topic, only to realize that every single blog talks about the exact same stuff. So over time, I pare it down to the people who I, you know, I consider to be the best sources on that. And that works a lot better. And on technology, I've found that I subscribe a lot less directly to technology news sites or blogs and more to just things like TechMeme, mm-hmm. where the best stuff will just percolate up. So if I grab an RSS feed on that, I get the headlines, I can bounce to the primary story. And if I want to really go deep on that particular topic, then I'll bounce over to TechMeme and see who else has written about it. And I don't know, for me, that's a major time saver.
Yeah. Yeah. How about you guys?
Twitter, baby.
All Twitter all the time. What about you, Phil?
I usually just shut down.
No, you go back to Better Homes and Gardens. That's your default.
That's pretty much, yeah, that's pretty much what I do. You know, I go back to surfing porn. You know, no, it's always a challenge. And, you know, we sit around and try to come up with ways to aggregate this knowledge. And, you know, it's the problem of the global view. When you start seeking out all this information, now you can find it. You know, you look back in the day, a simpler time when you just had one or two sources of information. Now you have multiple sources of information and unlimited access. It's just a matter of, I think it's always a challenge to every person individually to say, okay, what, you know, what do I really care about? You know, those of us that are extremely ADD, you know, I think all of us on this call or on this podcast right now are like that. It's like we want to know a little bit about everything. You just sort of have to start figuring out what's the priority. And the great thing for me is that you know, I'm at that point in my life where I've got two young kids, so they always bubble to the top of the priority list. So it's a little easier for me to shut off and move from one side to the other. But it's a challenge.
Yeah.
You know, in the case of podcasting, in that particular category, my biggest peeve there is podcasts where they take too long to say what the podcast is going to be about. Is the way I consume podcasts most often is while I'm running, and I'm using a Nano, so the screen is extraordinarily small, so I just bounce to the next episode, and sometimes it's a minute and a half into the thing before they actually say what that particular episode is going to be about. And for me, that's just brutal, because if the topic turns out to be something that's just not awesome, I'll just listen to something else. I mean, that's the beauty of this stuff. So, like, for example, the Fresh Air podcast that put out by Terry Gross on Asheville Public Radio. Sometimes she talks about politics. Sometimes she has a wide range of topics. But whenever it's a topic about, say, like an actor who's doing something, that's probably not one that I'm going to want to listen to. But I shouldn't need 90 seconds to find that out.
So you better record something at the beginning of this podcast, Steve.
I was just going to say, I was hoping he wasn't going to say, you know, I listen to that Minivate Gang podcast. These guys pontificate and go on and on. It takes me 9 minutes to figure out what the hell they're talking about.
The worst I hear on that is podcasts from conferences where they don't cut out all of the housekeeping notes at the start of a show.
God.
It's like, just so you know, we're going to have cookies after the break. And you know, so like, come on, guys, just tighten up, you know.
Yeah, I still have 28 podcasts from the South by Southwest conference last year to listen to
hurry, because it's going to start again soon.
I know.
Yeah, but you know what, Ed? You gave me a great suggestion a while back, which was don't put your hosts as the first part of the text in the blog post. Put what the podcast is about and then put the hosts second so that it shows up in iTunes properly.
Yeah, it's kind of like a little search engine optimization strategy for iTunes.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. That was a huge help.
That could also be considered, you know, what's important to the listener, Steve. Yeah.
That's right. I was just trying to make it look pretty. That's all.
There's this element of common sense that really should permeate everything we do.
Yeah. Yeah.
Hey, you know, getting back to your topic though, Steve, one of the ways that I've been able to consume or continue to consume podcasts is through other devices rather than the iPod. So TiVo actually plays a big role in that, where I'm able to get Techzilla and some other video podcasts automatically synced to my TiVo server, and then, you know, they show up as content on the TiVo and you can watch them on your TV. So I think that's that bridge is an important kind of thing. And I can listen to audio podcasts while I'm making dinner through the stereo kind of a thing too. So to me, getting it outside of just the, I have to listen to it on my iPod is key to trying to keep up with this stuff.
Well, you know what? I wanted to segue into something, which was, I know there's, you're working on a bunch of stuff, Ed, but this concept of lunch talks, that lunchtalks.com, I looked at that and I said, this is what a fabulous idea in terms of connecting people up and, you know, being able to essentially have a 1 hour ideation session discovery meeting.
Go ahead, give us the download on that, Ed. What do you do? Yeah. What's the concept behind Lunch Talks?
Okay, so Lunch Talks is, I'm trying to figure out the right term for it, but right now I'm going with micro consulting to describe it. And the idea is that there are a lot of times where a company is internally debating an issue and they just need a third person to come in who has some subject expertise, who can kind of help break the tie. Or maybe it's a situation where a company is considering starting something like blogging and they just need some high level advice on what are a few things that we need to know before we even go down this path. And a lot of times, if you get the right person in the room who really knows what they're talking about, you can accomplish a ton in an hour. They'll save you a lot of problems down the road. So my idea is to roll up people around town so far who have a lot of subject expertise and kind of create a consulting firm around that, where people can, you know, basically take them out to lunch for $300, $500. Every person can set their own rate on it and just tap their brain and have a really effective hour. And, you know, that's a concept. And I'm still working on trying to figure out how to kind of get that out there and rolling. And, but I think there's definitely a market for that. There are a lot of people who just need that person to talk to. So I think it'll work, but we'll see. It's just getting going. I have done it a few times, so I know people will pay for it and have been happy with the results. So just got to figure out how to spread the word on that one.
So is the
Sorry.
Go ahead. No, go ahead, Tim.
I was going to say, so how do you determine your pricing? I mean, I see you're 500, some other guys are 300 bucks. Just how does that all work?
Just how they value their own time and what they think someone would be willing to pay for it. So, and then, you know, the lunch talks, if I book it, you know, it's kind of like a speaker's fee type thing where, you know, I'll get a cut of that.
Uh-huh. Oh, okay.
Well, you know, the win-win here too is that just about everybody I know that's in the consulting game, you know, has a discovery meeting with someone to find out more about their needs and all of that. But at the same time, if I could, you know, I'd need 50 hands to be able to count the number of times I've gotten together with somebody for lunch so they can pick my brain. I mean, somebody that I know and you know, they've got some initiative or they've got some direction or whatever. And my wife keeps chastising me on, you know, you just gave that guy a $10,000 idea or, you know, blah, blah, blah. And so this is kind of an interesting model from that standpoint is that, you know, if you're going to go in and talk about a specific topic or have lunch around a specific topic, you're going to either have it all in your brain or you're going to prepare a little bit. And yeah,
I think that definitely is part of it. And I also see there are some companies that kind of abuse that, like as you're just kind of suggesting that, you know, that first hour where you get to know each other. You know, I'm trying to flip that a bit where people going in are looking for value. They're not, you know, you don't want the consultant to be holding back because they're hoping for billable hours later. It's like, no, let's put it out there. Let's accomplish something here.
Right. And so you also recently launched something called Third Party Feedback. Talk about that. What's the direction of that?
So Third Party Feedback is where I'm doing a crowdsourced website review service. So if you want to have some people who've never been to your website before give you an opinion of what they think of it, that's what this site is based around. So people can go to the site. It costs $25 for the initial introductory test to be run. And for $25, people get 10 people to answer 3 questions about their website for them. And those 3 questions are, what do you think this website does? Which is surprisingly how few people can figure out a lot of websites. Second question is, what's your favorite feature of this website? And a third question is, what's one thing this website could do better? And that those 3 questions are bounced out to 10 people. They give their replies to those, and it's rolled up in a 2-3 page report, and it's delivered within 24 hours. And people are getting incredible feedback out of this. And for people who just need, the biggest problem I see with a lot of people who are building websites is they're just too close to it. So a lot of times they just forget the really obvious stuff, like describing what they do. So this kind of gives them feedback from people who haven't been there before. If they can't figure it out, now you know you've got a problem to solve.
Oh, you know what? Have you ever gone to go2web20.net, which is that Flash-based listing of all the Web 2.0 companies?
Yeah.
So, yeah, like 8 quarters in a row, I went to that and went through every single category. I wouldn't do it all in one day. I would do it, break it up over the quarter, but I developed this gut level check on what I call the 30-second value proposition. If you can't tell me in 30 seconds what you do, I'm gone. And that sounds really harsh, but how many sites do you go to that have, 10 paragraphs, and it's going to take you 6 to 8 minutes to read it and absorb what the value prop is?
Yeah, or a lot of times it's like a flash design or something where you can't figure it out because it's like they're trying to play a game where, I've seen sites where the contact page will list the employees of the company, but it's done with pictures with no names, and you have to mouse over them to see what their name is. And, it's like a game of memory. I'm not a fan of that kind of stuff. Just tell us what we're doing here. But it's not my opinion on the case of third-party feedback. It's opinion of 10 independent visitors to the website, and they'll consistently often say, this sucks, guys. Solve this.
Yeah, I can see where independent web designers and UI shops could use this service on a regular basis to prove a point with clients or to just do quick testing of new sites that they're putting up,
And if I was the client, I would test the designers too. So when the site launches, see if it solves problems or not. So it's a good place to start the conversation before you ever start building things, because you can find out what people like right now and what they're having challenges with. So now you have some issues to address, in the design process.
Well, who are the 10 people though? How do you vet those 10 people, and what are their skills and backgrounds?
Right. I'm crowdsourcing it out through a service that's put out by Amazon called Mechanical Turk. So I put an assignment into that and put it out for bid. And so I adjust what I pay for the people to do the assignment based on how fast I need it to get done. The people who are doing the work right now, the stats say that they're, I think it's 90% Americans, 60% women. Most are college graduates, 70-80%. So it's actually a pretty good cross, cut of typical web users. And, I think the quality of the feedback is what kind of speaks for itself, but it's something where the demographics of the people using the site are really, the primary thing is they're people who've never been to your website before. Beyond that, they're not falling into any tight demographic where right now people can't say, I'm looking for males between the ages of 18 and 30, although that is something I could do.
Well, I'm just looking at Garrick Van Buren's blog post about the results. I mean, I'm just scanning it because I'm trying to pay attention to the podcast, but it just looks like the feedback is really fabulous.
Yeah, I think it, you know, it's something where not everyone wants feedback, but for people who do, they're going to get great feedback. And that kind of feedback that Garrick has there, that, you know, that's $25 worth of work.
Yep. Yep.
Wow.
So I know I've run, of course, third-party feedback through the site many times and gotten better and better reviews over time. You know, people, you know, you find out where they're stumbling. And like one thing I've changed based on feedback was I initially had 4 tests as the first few that when people came into the site, and I've tightened it up to 1 where it's like, here, just do this. Once you've done this, you know, at a low entry point, then they'll really get the concept. So moving ahead, there'll be additional reports that, you know, like an advanced reports page where if someone wants to get 100 opinions on a specific topic, or that I can, you know, obviously extend the list of questions that people might want to ask. Like one idea I have is to have a dating profile review. So people could, you know, say, take a look at my dating profile on match.com and let me know what I could be doing better with that. So it can go a lot of directions.
New hairstyle, shave your beard.
Yeah, you should be on Adult Friend Finder. What are you thinking?
Yeah. Oh man. Let's chat briefly about, and Graham, you're probably closer to this than everyone in terms of paying attention, but the Best Buy folks that took packages, do you think this is going to affect their online strategies in any way, or where? I mean, that was Brad Anderson even came out publicly and said his concern about offering all the headquarters employees packages was that it takes so long to find really good people. And he was concerned that they were going to have kind of a brain drain.
Well, yeah, but you know, they have a safety valve on that, that a lot of people may have missed. The 500 that have been reported that took the package, those are applications to management to take the package. The safety valve is, now they approve which ones are going to get it.
Got it.
Okay. So they can prevent some brain drain. You know, some people are going to get, potentially counter offers, if you will, to stay, or they just may flat out refuse to accept certain people's resignations under this package. So the question is, what will that final number be? Will it be 350 or 400 or what? They did announce that they took a $60 million hit to fourth quarter earnings for these supposed 500. But you know, I question whether it will be 500. It won't. When you divide 60 million by 500, it's only 120,000 each, which would suggest that that seems low to me based on the unbelievable severance packages these people are getting. So that must only include salaries and not benefits, which I'm told by a former insider that the benefits cost of this could be prorated out over time. But we've heard that VPs are getting a minimum of 2 years severance, executive VPs a minimum of 3 years. I don't know that this is true. This is just what I'm hearing from people who are in the know. And one executive VP I heard got 45 months severance.
Wow.
Or would under the terms of the agreement if he's accepted. And again, I believe they said that, is it January 16th when they're going to announce who was accepted or not? So, you know, this story is not over yet. But I do see it. You know, you were talking about if we could talk about some good news on this podcast about what's happening locally. A lot of people are seeing this as quite good news. And I tweeted about this morning that you could say that this is the biggest influx of capital for small business formation in a long time in Minnesota, because a large number of these folks are going to go off and start cottage businesses.
Right, right.
We're going to see more consultants in the local, hidden quote unquote consulting economy than we've seen in a long time. Although, you know, many of them will have plenty of time to to work their way up to it. And somebody asked me on Twitter this morning or last night, does this mean that there'll be a lot of employees going to startups? And my reaction to that is, I think very few of them are going to be a fit for a startup. And I wouldn't expect to see a lot of that. But certainly we'll see a ton of them going into consulting or other businesses. You know, they may start a business, they may join another small business, but I think the vast majority of them will probably end up going back to work for a big company at some point in time. That would be my take.
Well, one of the articles that was in the paper or online, I can't remember where I saw it, was about one of the senior VPs there, Julie Gilbert, who started the Women's Leadership Forum called WOLF.
Right.
And which was a, you know, resounding success. And she's just a ball of fire and energy. And she took the package. She's going to step out and essentially create the program for other companies to do the same sort of thing. So there's one example of somebody that's taking it. Now, whether she stays here or moves, I don't know, but.
Well, she'll probably stay. I mean, I doubt many people are going to pick up and leave town, but it's a sweetheart deal. They get a bunch of money to help bankroll their new venture. And, you know, Brad Anderson and company end up creating a bunch of entrepreneurs here, that some of whom will be quite successful, I'm sure, ongoing. I've heard the names of many senior execs that are going. I haven't heard too many mid-level ones. A couple of guys we expected, I did, to go, have elected to stay, and I think you guys know who they are, our social media friends over there. But
right.
But there have been some big names that have elected to at least apply to take the package. So it'll be interesting to see how this shakes out. One thing I did hear from an informed source is that Best Buy needs to cut more than $90 million in SG&A now. The question is, are these 500 enough? Or assuming even all 500 get accepted, well, will we then see more layoffs? I'm told by an inside, an informed source, that probably not, that this should be enough to save that much money, certainly counting benefits and that's and related costs. But we shall see. I think we'll know more. The other thing I heard is this is actually a pretty good time for them to be taking that hit with the market down like it is now. It's as good a time as any. If they were going to do it, you know, this was the quarter.
Yeah, do as much as you can when times are bad.
Yep. Yeah, it's kind of like the Y2K situation where you can justify a lot of things based on a macro level thing.
Yeah.
I would like to see some of these guys who are, you know, coming out of there, if they have some money in the bank, and if one of the reasons for wanting to leave a company as large as Best Buy is that things just move a little too slow. You know, I'm sure there are some people that kind of have that mindset. Well, those people should really try to find people in the local startup community who are capable of moving very, very fast, who don't have a lot of money, but, you know, might be onto something pretty cool. You know, there's some great partnership opportunities there, I'm sure. So with a little bit of money and experience working on a large scale, put that together with some people who can move really fast and just need to ramp up the business side of their startup, I could see some really cool stuff coming out of this.
Well, and I agree, Ed. I think that, there are some people over there that obviously want things to move faster, but like I say, a couple of those people I expected to jump didn't. I think on the plus side, though, I think there are startups that could partner up with some of these folks and improve their lot in life. And my friend Kim Gerritsen said he was being approached by funded startups that were asking that question, is can we tap into any of this talent? And, you know, will it help us? And so, yeah, I like to think that some good things will come out of it, even though a lot of these big company people just aren't going to do well in a startup environment, I've seen from past experience. But But overall, I think it's, you know, we can see some positives out of this. And I was going to say, Steve, on your original question, I don't think it will affect some of these strategic online efforts of Best Buy. You know, I think Kevin Matheny may have answered part of that for us last week. I think, you know, initiatives like his Remix program won't suffer. It's already lean and mean. You know, they know how to do these things lean and mean.
Yep.
So, you know, and the company will do just fine. You know, the tough times will pass and you know, consumer electronics will pick back up. I saw it was down, their sales were down 6.5%, store sales in December. Interestingly, though, I don't know if you read online, BestBuy.com was up 34%. So go e-commerce, you know?
Yeah.
Anyway, they'll do fine. And I think we'll see a lot of innovation continue to come out of there and that we won't see as much brain drain as maybe we thought we would, particularly if some of these people aren't allowed to take the package. So that's my take on this whole thing.
One of the things that I wanted to, we just got a few minutes left, but I just wanted to touch on, because it's kind of this big policy thing that's hanging out there. And we've got the Minnesota Ultra High-Speed Broadband Task Force. We've got, you know, the Blandon on Broadband Initiative going on here in the state, and all this stuff's happening with broadband. And yet, you know, Business Week has been keeping their finger on the pulse of what Obama's broadband plan is, which is a $20 to $30 billion effort for tax breaks for companies that extend the availability of broadband or where it already exists to boost the speed of the service. And there seems to be a lot of wood behind the bat for them to try to hit a home run here with opening up the infrastructure. And I think of a guy like you, Ed, that has, you know, 97 sites and you're online all the time. I mean, you are the, you know, the quintessential always on, always connected kind of person, and are trying a lot of different things that are web hosted. So something like that would be a real boon to you. And what are your thoughts about bigger pipes and more ubiquitous access?
Well, it definitely has to happen. I jokingly talked to some friends of mine about how the internet that I use is different than the internet a lot of people use, just because I have access to, you know, fast pipes. And, you know, of course I've over time learned about a lot of websites that just make my life easier. But on the national, you know, so compared to someone who is on dial up, for example, they can't use the internet the way I do. You know, it's just not possible for them. You know, it's impossible. They don't have the speed. They wouldn't be able to have the patience. But at a national level, it seems like the definition of broadband, I'm pretty sure, is still a pretty low bar. Like, it's like a introductory DSL speeds, I'm pretty sure, you know, like 256 or maybe 512K. I don't know. It's low. Like, it's not up in the megs by any means. So as part of this, I'd like to see the definition of broadband turned up to something that can realistically be called broadband in 2009, and then figure out ways to expand things out from there. I think as a country, we probably benefit more by getting people up to a meg across the board than we do by taking someone who's at, say, 6 megs and getting them to 60. I mean, of course, I'll take that. But, you know, as far as, you know, how are we really going to improve the quality of communications in this country? If we can get everyone to a point where things work, like online video works and using, you know, voice over IP can work for them, that's a huge step from where we are today. And as a country, we're definitely not there yet. I've wondered about the digital divide in things like Minneapolis. Like, I know I've heard that in my neighborhood, I live in the Longfellow neighborhood, kind of over by the river in Minneapolis. And I look around the houses by me, and the average number of computers per home is pretty close to 1-to-1, where, you know, people have a work computer they bring home. They each have a computer at home. However it works out, almost everyone has their own computer. But if you go just a few miles to the west of me over to the Phillips neighborhood, as I understand it, at home, the rate right now is closer to one computer for every 16 people. And if that's the case, people are just going to have an entirely different view of the world because they don't have access to information. So there are definitely some issues in terms of just raising the bar, you know, from the bottom that I think need to be solved more than anything as far as national policy issues go.
Well, I was surprised when I started to read online about the iPhone, and about one of the surprises with the iPhone was the fact that people were buying it in lieu of a computer and broadband, meaning people that were low income. And so I'm wondering about, you know, because you can do so much with it. You can have email, you can surf the web, you can do all these things. And now with the Palm Pre and the Google Android-based handsets and the iPhone, you know, possibly that'll be the entry point for those in the digital divide, because it'll be less expensive to get, you know, a phone plan with a data plan and a phone itself than it would be to get a computer and a broadband connection. Does that hold any water? Does that pass the smell test for you guys?
Yeah, it does to a certain extent. We're seeing the demographics of iPhone users going down in income. Average income started out where it was, you know, where's a percentage were 100,000 and above in income, and latest studies have shown those demographics coming down quite a bit. So yeah, I think people are using it as their main computer, maybe their only computer. It's feasible, you know?
Well, I could see that with 3G rolling out here, that you could use a 3G modem and replace your internet access at home with that, because when you're out and about, you've got your phone with you with that access, and then when you're home, you just stick the phone in the router or hook it up, however it works.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Because 3G is actually fairly robust as far as data speeds, and would be usable for a lot of people. Not Ed, but for a lot of people, it would be fine.
Yeah.
What I'd like to see is AT&T come out with a plan where it has a data plan, a text plan, but it's a flat fee or pay as you go for the voice plan, because that does absolutely nothing for me. You know, my voice amount usage is going down and down and down to the point of almost being non-existent. So that sort of a plan, I think, could actually work for a lot of people where you know, they're able to use the phone as a computer from anywhere, but as a phone, you know, people are doing text more and more and more. Like the amount of the actually, I was looking yesterday at the amount of time people spend on a phone call is actually at its lowest amount since 2000. And cell phones in 2000, that was an entirely different animal than it is in 2009, where at that time people were really cautious about just talking on the phone. You know, they kept their calls tight because it was expensive. And over time, calls got longer. They went from about 2.5 minutes up to around 3.5 on average. But now they're back down to 2.5, which to me says people are getting most of their conversation done on text. And then they pick up the phone if they have to just say, okay, where are you? I don't see you. Okay, where are you? And they hang up the phone.
You know what's really fascinating about that is that, so my wife's going to go over to Europe on Monday for her first of 5 trips over the next couple months. And she's taking her iPhone, but we're not going to do the data plan. And the Mac 2.8 beta of Skype has a connection with Boingo, the Wi-Fi access service, where you can actually use your Skype minutes to connect up with any Wi-Fi location that Boingo offers. And you do it right through Skype, and you can make Skype calls. Now, that's not for net access. You can't do data. But for voice, it's there. So, you know, why couldn't the next step be, I'm doing that with my phone. I'm pulling up Fring or some other VoIP app that lets me connect up with my Skype and make calls over Wi-Fi and just use the... So you can kind of see where that's going. So in those times when the Ed Kohlers of the world need to make a voice call, if you can wait, you can end up connecting up with a Wi-Fi connection. Maybe just use an iPod Touch or some non-telephony.
What you're describing there is the phone carrier's biggest nightmare.
Yeah.
And that technology could obviously be done today.
It's all there. Yeah. The carriers are going to be the ones holding this back.
Yep. I didn't go to the Consumer Electronics Show this year, but I've gone the last few years, and it's always amazing to look at the quality of the phones that are being created by the manufacturers. there are a lot of things they can do where you look at the phones, you're like, that'll be awesome when they hit the market. They're like, yeah, well, you know, when that hits the market, it's not going to have this feature or this feature or this feature. Or if it has this feature, they're going to charge you for it. And, you know, the phones are really disabled in terms of what they can do.
Yep.
Because the carriers, they have to figure out how to build a business model around the gadget. So expecting to see a phone that makes it easy to make, you know, voice over IP calls that don't use your minutes, that's it's going to be a while till we see that, I think.
Well, and I had a buddy that ran a couple of groups for Palm, left about a year ago, year and a half ago. And I ended up writing a white paper for him for the education space a couple of years ago. And I gained a new appreciation for the hoops that Palm had to jump through to get their phones certified and approved by the carriers. And I'm sure Steve Jobs had an atypical amount of control over AT&T with respect to the iPhone. But even so, with the control that they've got over the apps, you'll notice that, of course, you can't use certain functions. And I can't remember if it's Fring or what iPhone app, but you can't connect through Skype in any way but through a Wi-Fi network. They won't let you do it over 3G. They've disabled it. And apparently with a jailbroken iPhone, you can hack it. And so it will work over 3G. And everyone says it works great.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Well, Skype works fine on 3G on my MacBook.
Does it?
Yeah. I've driven across the country. I think, I remember, didn't you do this one time, Steve, where you were driving somewhere using Skype because you're on a data card?
I was using iChat video tethered. I was tethered to my Trio on the Verizon EVDO network. I was coming back from Florida with my daughter. She'd been down there. We'd shipped her car down to her. And then I flew down and drove back with her. And I got to tell you, I was connected at one point for an hour and a half on the interstate and making making iChat connections with my wife, her mom, and, you know, doing video. Now, video is running like at 4 frames a second, but it was video. I mean, it was one of the most amazing experiences.
I do that all the time when I'm driving along with one of my coworkers. I'll ride shotgun and surf the web and pull up interesting stories in Google Reader and then play some videos. And I use a stereo jack to plug my computer into the, the car's audio jack. So it works great. You know, YouTube becomes our jukebox and we're just rolling along.
Oh, that's great. As long as you're riding shotgun, Ed.
Yeah, I'm definitely a shotgun.
Oh, man. Well, listen, guys, we're running up against our hour here. I wanted to leave you with one thing, and I'm sure you're all going. So I just want to get that out of the way up front. But in today's paper, Full Court Perez, celebrity blogger Perez Hilton hits the Mall of America today. Will he be naughty or nice? And I know you guys are huge Perez Hilton fans. Are you going?
No.
Should we do a meetup?
No, I'm going to St. Cloud.
Okay, all right. Ed?
I think I have some laundry I have to do or something.
Well, I know Phil's there. He's really quiet, Phil.
So. I'm planning. I'm picking out my wardrobe now.
Well, have you dyed your hair pink, Phil?
You know, you got to fit in.
Yeah, all right.
A pink mohawk would be cool.
Very nice. You know,
as far as Minnesota startups go, there needs to be a local Perez Hilton. I can't think of who that person would be, but Minnesota
needs
one.
That's Graham Thicket. That's Graham.
Oh, okay.
Whatever happened to Wanda Wisdom? Because I thought he was sort of that Perez Hilton-y kind of character.
I don't know. We got someone that's really got to tap into, you know, using all the social media features they can around town, and, you know, someone could do it. You know, it's not CJ from the Strib. It's got to be someone a little edgier who really puts it out there.
Huh.
Well, who knows? Maybe CJ will be out there looking for
Yeah, she may be.
All right. Hey, with that, we'll sign off. Ed, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, guys.
And everybody have a great weekend.
Thanks.
You too.
Yeah. Thank you.